Chapter 3. I told all this to Jan at around 11 o'clock that morning. The next morning, I almost wrote, but of course it was the same day. The longest one of my whole life, without a doubt. I told it pretty much as I have here, finishing with how William Wharton had ended up lying dead on his bunk, riddled with lead from Percy's sidearm. No, that's not right. What I actually finished with was the stuff that came out of Percy, the bugs or the whatever it was. That was a hard thing to tell, even to your wife. But I told it. As I talked, she brought me black coffee by the half cup. At first my hands were shaking too badly to pick up a whole one without spilling it. By the time I finished, the shaking had eased some, and I felt that I could even take some food, an egg maybe, or some soup. The thing that saved us was that we didn't really have to lie, any of us. "Just leave a few things out," she said, and nodded. "Little things, mostly, like how you took a condemned murderer out of prison, and how he cured a dying woman, and how he drove that Percy Wetmore crazy by, what, spitting a pureed brain tumor down his throat?" "I don't know, Jan," I said. "I only know that if you keep talking like that, you'll end up either eating that soup yourself or feeding it to the dog." "I'm sorry. But I'm right, aren't I?" "Yeah," I said. "Except we got away with the what? You couldn't call it an escape. And furlough wasn't right either. The field trip. Not even Percy can tell him about that if he ever comes back."
"If he comes back," she echoed. "How likely is that?"
I shook my head to indicate I had no idea. But I did, actually. I didn't think he was going to come back. Not in 1932, not in 42 or 52 either. In that I was right. Percy Wetmore stayed at Briar Ridge until it burned flat in 1944. 17 inmates were killed in that fire, but Percy wasn't one of them. Still silent and blank in every regard, the word I learned to describe that state is catatonic, he was led out by one of the guards long before the fire reached his wing. He went on to another institution, I don't remember the name, and guess it doesn't matter anyway, and died in 1965. So far as I know, the last time he ever spoke was when he told us we could clock him out at quitting time, unless we wanted to explain why he had left early. The irony was that we never had to explain much of anything. Percy had gone crazy and shot William Wharton to death. That was what we told, and so far as it went, every word was true. When Anderson asked Brutal how Percy had seemed before the shooting, and Brutal answered with one word, quiet, I had a terrible moment when I felt that I might burst out laughing. Because that was true, too. Percy had been quiet. For most of his shift, he'd had a swatch of friction tape across his mouth, and the best he'd been able to come up with was, Curtis kept Percy there until 8 o'clock. Percy is silent as a cigar store Indian, but a lot more eerie. By then, Hal Moores had arrived, looking grim but competent, ready to climb back into the saddle. Curtis Anderson let him do just that, and with a sigh of relief the rest of us could almost hear, the bewildered, frightened old man was gone. It was the warden who strode up to Percy, grabbed him by the shoulders with his big hands, and shook him hard. "Son!" he shouted into Percy's blank face, a face that was already starting to soften like wax, I thought. "Son! Do you hear me? Talk to me if you hear me. I want to know what happened." Nothing from Percy, of course. Anderson wanted to get the warden aside, discuss how they were going to handle it. It was a political hot potato if there had ever been one, but Moores put him off, at least for the time being, and drew me down the mile. John Coffey was lying on his bunk with his face to the wall, legs dangling outrageously as they always did. He appeared to be sleeping, and probably was, but he wasn't always what he appeared, as we had found out. "Did what happened at my house have anything to do with what happened here when you got back?" Moores asked in a low voice. "I'll cover you as much as I can, even if it means my job, but I have to know." I shook my head. When I spoke, I also kept my voice low-pitched. There were now almost a dozen screws milling around at the head of the aisle. Another was photographing Wharton in his cell.
Curtis Anderson had turned to watch that, and for the time being, only Brutal was watching us. No, sir. We got John back into his cell, just like you see, then let Percy out of the restraint room where we'd stashed him for safekeeping. I thought he'd be hot under the collar, but he wasn't. Just asked for his sidearm and baton. He didn't say anything else, just walked off up the corridor. Then when he got to Wharton's cell, he pulled his gun and started shooting. Do you think being in the restraint room did something to his mind? No, sir. Did you put him in a straitjacket? No, sir, there was no need. He was quiet, didn't struggle. No struggle. Even when he saw you meant to put him in the restraint room, he was quiet and didn't struggle. That's right. I felt an urge to embroider on this, to give Percy at least a line or two, and conquered it. Simpler would be better, and I knew it. There was no fuss. He just went over into one of the far corners and sat down. Didn't speak of Wharton then. No, sir. Didn't speak of coffee, either. I shook my head. Could Percy have been laying for Wharton? Did he have something against the man? That might be, I said, lowering my voice even more. Percy was careless about where he walked, Hal. One time Wharton reached out, grabbed him up against the bars, and messed him over some. I paused. Felt him up, he could say. No worse than that. Just messed him over, and that was all? Yes, but it was pretty bad for Percy just the same. Wharton said something about how he'd rather screw Percy than Percy's sister. Oh. Moores kept looking sideways at John Coffey, as if he needed constant reassurance that Coffey was a real person, actually in the world. It doesn't explain what's happened to him, but it goes a good piece toward explaining why it was Wharton he turned on and not Coffey or one of you men. And speaking of your men, Paul, will they all tell the same story? Yes, sir, I told him. And they will, I said to Jan, starting in on the soup she brought to the table. I'll see to it.
You did lie, just a little, she said. You lied to Hal.
Well, that's a wife for you, isn't it? Always poking around for moth holes in your best suit and finding one more often than not. I guess, if you want to look at it that way. I didn't tell him anything we both won't be able to live with, though. Hal's in the clear, I think. He wasn't even there, after all. He was home, tending his wife, until Curtis called him.
Did he say how Melinda was?
Not then. There wasn't time, but we spoke again just as Brutal and I were leaving. Melly doesn't remember much, but she's fine. Up and walking, talking about next year's flower beds. My wife sat, watching me eat for some little time. Then she asked,
Does Hal know it's a miracle, Paul? Does he understand that?
Yes. We all do. All of us that were there.
Part of me wishes I'd been there, too, she said. But I think most of me is glad I wasn't. If I'd seen the scales fall from Saul's eyes on the road to Damascus, I probably would have died of a heart attack.
Nah, I said, tilting my bowl to capture the last spoonful. Probably would have cooked him some soup. This is pretty fine, hon.
Good.
But she wasn't really thinking about soup, or cooking, or Saul's conversion on the Damascus Road. She was looking out the window toward the ridges, her chin propped on her hand, her eyes as hazy as those ridges look on summer mornings when it's going to be hot. Summer mornings like the one when the Dederick girls had been found. I thought for no reason. I wondered why they hadn't screamed. Their killer had hurt them. There had been blood on the porch and on the steps, so why hadn't they screamed?
You think John Coffey really killed that man Wharton, don't you? Janice asked, looking back from the window at last. Not that it was an accident or anything like that. You think he used Percy Wetmore on Wharton like a gun?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know.
Tell me again about what happened when you took Coffey off the mile, would you? Just that part.
So I did.
I told her how the skinny arms shooting out from between the bars and grabbing John's bicep had reminded me of a snake, one of the water moccasins we were all scared of when we were kids swimming in the river, and how Coffee had said Wharton was a bad man, almost whispering it.
"And Wharton said..." My wife was looking out the window again, but she was listening all right.
"Wharton said, 'That's right, nigger, bad as you'd want.'
And that's all."
"Yes. I had a feeling that something was going to happen right then, but nothing did. Brutal took Wharton's hand off John and told him to lie down, which Wharton did. He was out on his feet to start with. Said something about how niggers should have their own electric chair, and that was all. We went about our business."
"John Coffey called him a bad man."
"Yep. Said the same thing about Percy once, too. Maybe more than once. I can't remember exactly when, but I know he did."
"But Wharton never did anything to John Coffey personally, did he? Like he did to Percy, I mean."
"No. The way their cells were, Wharton up by the duty desk on one side, John down a ways on the other, they could hardly see each other."
"Tell me again how Coffey looked when Wharton grabbed him."
"Janice, this isn't getting us anywhere."
"Maybe it isn't, and maybe it is. Tell me again how he looked."
I sighed. "I guess you'd have to say he's shocked. He gasped. Like you would if you were sunning at the beach and I snuck up and trickled a little cold water down your back. Or like he'd been slapped."
"Well, sure," she said. "Being grabbed out of nowhere like that startled him. Woke him up for a second."
"Yes," I said. "And then, no."
"Well, which is it, yes or no?"
"No. It wasn't being startled. It was like when he wanted me to come into his cell so he could cure my infection, or when he wanted me to hand him the mouse. It was being surprised, but not by being touched. Not exactly, anyway. Oh, Christ, Jan, I don't know."
"All right, we'll leave it," she said. "I just can't imagine why John did it, that's all. It's not as if he's violent by nature." "Which leads to another question, Paul. How can you execute him if you're right about those girls? How can you possibly put him in the electric chair if someone else..." I jerked in my chair. My elbow struck my bowl and knocked it off onto the floor where it broke. An idea had come to me. It was more intuition than logic at that point, but it had a certain black elegance.
"Paul?" Janice asked, alarmed. "What's wrong?"
"I don't know," I said. "I don't know anything for sure, but I'm going to find out if I can."
Chapter 4. The aftermath of the shooting was a three-ring circus, with the governor in one ring, the prison in another, and poor brain-blasted Percy Wetmore in the third. And the ringmaster? Well, the various gentlemen of the press took turns at that job. They weren't as bad then as they are now. They didn't allow themselves to be as bad. But even back then, before Geraldo and Mike Wallace and the rest of them, they could gallop along pretty good when they really got the bit in their teeth. That was what happened this time, and while the show lasted, it was a good one. But even the liveliest circus, the one with the scariest freaks, funniest clowns, and wildest animals, has to leave town eventually. This one left after the Board of Inquiry, which sounds pretty special and fearsome, but actually turned out to be pretty tame and perfunctory. Under other circumstances, the governor undoubtedly would have demanded someone's head on a platter, but not this time. His nephew, by marriage, his wife's own blood kin, had gone crackers and killed a man. Had killed a killer, there was that, at least, and thank God for it. But Percy had still shot the man as he lay sleeping in his cell, which was not quite sporting. When you added in the fact that the young man in question remained just as mad as a March hare, you could understand why the governor only wanted it to go away, and as soon as possible. Our trip to Warden Moore's house in Harry Terwilliger's truck never came out. The fact that Percy had been straitjacketed and locked in the restraint room during the time we were away never came out. The fact that William Wharton had been doped to the gills when Percy shot him never came out either. Why would it? The authorities had no reason to suspect anything in Wharton's system but half a dozen slugs.
A coroner removed those, a mortician put him in a pine box, and that was the end of the man with Billy the Kid tattooed on his left forearm. Good riddance to bad rubbish, you might say. All in all, the uproar lasted about 2 weeks. During that time, I didn't dare fart sideways, let alone take a day off to investigate the idea I'd gotten at my kitchen table on the morning after all the upheavals. I knew for sure that the circus had left town when I got to work on a day just shy of the middle of November, the 12th, I think, but don't hold me to that. That was the day I found the piece of paper I'd been dreading on the middle of my desk. The DOE on John Coffey. Curtis Anderson had signed it instead of Hal Moore's, but of course it was just as legal either way. And of course it had needed to go through Hal in order to get to me. I could imagine Hal sitting at his desk in administration with that piece of paper in his hand, sitting there and thinking of his wife, who had become something of a 9 days wonder to the doctors at Indianola General Hospital. She'd had her own DOE papers handed to her by those doctors, but John Coffey had torn them up. Now, however, it was Coffey's turn to walk the Green Mile. And who among us could stop it? Who among us would stop it? The date on the death warrant was November 20th. 3 days after I got it, the 15th, I think, I had Janice call me in sick. A cup of coffee later, I was driving north in my badly sprung but otherwise reliable Ford. Janice had kissed me on my way and wished me good luck. I'd thanked her, but no longer had any clear idea what good luck would be, finding what I was looking for or not finding it. All I knew for sure is that I didn't feel much like singing as I drove. Not that day. By 3 that afternoon, I was well up in the Ridge Country. I got to the Purdom County Courthouse just before it closed, looked at some records, then had a visit from the sheriff, who had been informed by the county clerk that a stranger was poking in amongst the local skeletons. Sheriff Catlett wanted to know what I thought I was doing. I told him. Catlett thought it over and then told me something interesting. He said he'd deny he'd ever said a word if I spread it around, and it wasn't conclusive anyway. But it was something, all right. It was sure something. I thought about it all the way home, and that night there was a lot of thinking and precious little sleeping on my side of the bed. The next day I got up while the sun was still just a rumor in the east and drove downstate to Topringas County. I skirted around Homer Cribus, that great bag of guts and water, speaking to Deputy Sheriff Rob McGee instead. McGee didn't want to hear what I was telling him, most vehemently didn't want to hear it. At one point, I was pretty sure he was going to punch me in the mouth so he could stop hearing it, but in the end, he agreed to go out and ask Klaus Dederich a couple of questions. Mostly, I think, so he could be sure I wouldn't. "He's only 39, but he looks like an old man these days," McGee said. "And he don't need a smart-ass prison guard who thinks he's a detective to stir him up just when some of the sorrow has started to settle. You stay right here in town. I don't want you within hailing distance of the Dederich farm, but I want to be able to find you when I'm done talking to Klaus. If you start feeling restless, have a piece of pie down there in a diner. It'll weight you down." I ended up having 2 pieces, and it was kind of heavy. When McGee came into the diner and sat down at the counter next to me, I tried to read his face, and failed. "Well?" I asked. "Come on home with me. We'll talk there," he said. "This place is a mite too public for my taste." We had our conference on Rob McGee's front porch. Both of us were bundled up and chilly, but Mrs. McGee didn't allow smoking anywhere in her house. She was a woman ahead of her time. McGee talked a while. He did it like a man who doesn't in the least enjoy what he's hearing out of his own mouth. "It proves nothing. You know that, don't you?" he asked when he was pretty well done. His tone was belligerent, and he poked his home-rolled cigarette at me in an aggressive way as he spoke. But his face was sick. Not all proof is what you see and hear in a court of law, and we both knew it. I have an idea that was the only time in his life when Deputy McGee wished he was as country dumb as his boss. "I know," I said. "And if you're thinking of getting him a new trial on the basis of this one thing, you better think again, Senor. John Coffey is a Negro. and in Trepangas County we're awful particular about giving new trials to Negroes.
I know that, too.
So what are you going to do?
I pitched my cigarette over the porch rail and into the street. Then I stood up. It was going to be a long, cold ride back home, and the sooner I got going, the sooner the trip would be done.
That I wish I did know, Deputy McGee, I said, but I don't. The only thing I know tonight for a fact is that second piece of pie was a mistake.
I'll tell you something, smart guy, he said, still speaking in that tone of hollow belligerence. I don't think you should have opened Pandora's box in the first place.
It wasn't me opened it, I said, and then drove home. I got there late, after midnight, but my wife was waiting up for me. I'd suspected she would be, but it still did my heart good to see her, and to have her put her arms around my neck and her body nice and firm against mine.
Hello, stranger, she said, and then touched me down below. Nothing wrong with this fella now, is there? He's just as healthy as can be.
Yes, ma'am, I said, and lifted her up in my arms. I took her into the bedroom, and we made love as sweet as sugar. And as I came to my climax, that delicious feeling of going out and letting go, I thought of John Coffey's endlessly weeping eyes, and of Melinda Moore's saying, I dreamed you were wandering in the dark, and so was I. Still lying on top of my wife, with her arms around my neck and our thighs together, I began to weep myself.
Paul,
she said, shocked and afraid. I don't think she'd seen me in tears more than half a dozen times before in the entire course of our marriage. I have never been in the ordinary course of things a crying man.
Paul, what is it?
I know everything there is to know, I said through my tears. I know too goddamn much if you want to know the truth. I'm supposed to electrocute John Coffey in less than a week's time, but it was William Wharton who killed the Dederick girls. It was Wild Bill.
Chapter 5. The next day, the same bunch of screws who had eaten lunch in my kitchen after the botched Delacroix execution ate lunch there again. This time there was a fifth at our council of war, my wife. It was Jan who convinced me to tell the others. My first impulse had been not to. Wasn't it bad enough, I asked her, that we knew?
You're not thinking clear about it, she'd answered, probably because you're still upset. They already know the worst thing, that John's on the spot for a crime he didn't commit. If anything, this makes it a little better.
I wasn't so sure, but I deferred to her judgment. I expected an uproar when I told Brutal, Dean, and Harry what I knew. I couldn't prove it, but I knew, all right. But at first there was only thoughtful silence. Then, taking another of Janice's biscuits and beginning to put an outrageous amount of butter on it, Dean said, Did John see him, do you think? Did he see Wharton drop the girls, maybe even rape them?
I think if he'd seen that, he would have tried to stop it, I said. As for seeing Wharton, maybe as he ran off, I suppose he might have. If he did, he forgot it later.
Sure, Dean said. He's special, but that doesn't make him bright. He only found out it was Wharton when Wharton reached through the bars of his cell and touched him.
Brutal was nodding. That's why John looked so surprised, so shocked. Remember the way his eyes opened?
I nodded. He used Percy on Wharton like a gun. That was what Janice said, and it was what I kept thinking about. Why would John Coffey want to kill Wild Bill? Percy, maybe. Percy stamped on Delacroix's mouse right in front of him. Percy burned Delacroix alive, and John knew it. But Wharton? Wharton messed with most of us in one way or another, but he didn't mess with John at all, so far as I know. Hardly passed 4 dozen words with him the whole time they were on the mile together, and half of those were that last night.
Why would he want to? He was from Purdom County, and as far as white boys from up there are concerned, you don't even see a Negro unless he happens to step into your road.
So why did he do it? What could he have seen or felt when Wharton touched him that was so bad that he saved back the poison he took out of Melly's body? And half killed himself doing it, too, Brutal said. More like three quarters. And the Dederick twins were all I could think of that was bad enough to explain what he did. I told myself the idea was nuts. Too much of a coincidence. It just couldn't be. Then I remembered something Curtis Anderson wrote in the first memo I ever got about Wharton, that Wharton was crazy wild and that he'd rambled all over the state before the holdup where he killed all those people. Rambled all over the state. That stuck with me. And there was the way he tried to choke Dean when he came in. That got me thinking about the dog, Dean said. He was rubbing his neck where Wharton had wrapped the chain. I don't think he even knew he was doing it. How the dog's neck was broken. Anyway, I went on up to Purdom County to check Wharton's court records. All we had here were the reports on the murders that got him to the Green Mile. The end of his career, in other words. I wanted the beginning.
Lot of trouble? Brutal asked.
Yeah. Vandalism, petty theft, setting haystack fires, even theft of an explosive. He and a friend swiped a stick of dynamite and set it off down by a creek. He got going early, 10 years old. But what I wanted wasn't there. Then the sheriff turned up to see who I was and what I was doing, and that was actually lucky. I fibbed, told him that a cell search had turned up a bunch of pictures in Wharton's mattress, little girls with no clothes on. I said I'd wanted to see if Wharton had any kind of history as a pederast, because there were a couple of unsolved cases up in Tennessee that I'd heard about. I was careful never to mention the Dederick twins. I don't think they crossed his mind either.
Of course not,
Harry said. Why would they have? That case is solved, after all. I said I guess there was no sense chasing the idea, since there was nothing in Wharton's back file. I mean, there was plenty in the file, but none of it about that sort of thing. Then the sheriff, Catlett, his name is, laughed and said not everything a bad apple like Bill Wharton did was in the court files. And what did it matter anyway? He was dead, wasn't he? I said I was doing it just to satisfy my own curiosity. Nothing else. And that relaxed him. He took me back to his office, sat me down, gave me a cup of coffee and a sinker, and told me that 16 months ago, when Wharton was barely 18, a man in the western part of the county caught him in the barn with his daughter. It wasn't rape, exactly. The fellow described it to Catlett as not much more than stink finger. Sorry, honey.
That's all right, Janice said. She looked pale, though.
How old was the girl? Brutal asked. 9, I said. He winced. The man might have taken off after Wharton himself if he'd had him some big old brothers or cousins to give him a help, but he didn't. So he went to Catlett, but made it clear he only wanted Wharton warned. No one wants a nasty thing like that right out in public if it can be helped. Anyway, Sheriff C. had been dealing with Wharton's antics for quite some time, had him in the reform school up that way for 8 months or so when Wharton was 15, and he decided enough was enough. He got 3 deputies. They went out to the Wharton place, set Mrs. Wharton aside when she started to weep and wail, and then they warned Mr. William Billy the Kid Wharton what happens to big pimple-faced galoots who go up in the hayloft with girls not even old enough to have heard about their monthly courses, let alone started them. We warned that little punk good, Catlett told me. Warned him until his head was bleeding, his shoulder was dislocated, and his ass was damn near broke. Brutal was laughing in spite of himself.
That sounds like Purdom County, all right, he said, like as not.
It was 3 months later, give or take, that Wharton broke out and started on the spree that ended with the holdup, I said. That and the murders that got him to us.
So he'd had something to do with an underage girl once, Harry said.
He took off his glasses, huffed on them, polished them.
Why underage? Once isn't exactly a pattern, is it?
A man doesn't do a thing like that just once, my wife said,
then pressed her lips together so tight they almost weren't there. Next, I told them about my visit to Trepingas County. I'd been a lot more frank with Rob McGee. I'd had no choice, really. To this day, I have no idea what sort of story he spun for Mr. Dederick, but the McGee who sat down next to me in the diner seemed to have aged 7 years. In mid-May, About a month before the holdup and the murders which had finished Wharton's short career as an outlaw, Klaus Dederich had painted his barn, and, incidentally, Bowser's doghouse next to it. He hadn't wanted his son crawling around up on a high scaffolding, and the boy had been in school anyway. So he had hired a fella. A nice enough fella. Very quiet. 3 days' work it had been. No, the fella hadn't slept at the house. Dederich wasn't foolish enough to believe that nice and quiet always meant safe, especially nowadays when there's so much dust bowl riff-raff on the roads, a man with a family had to be careful. In any case, the man hadn't needed lodging. He told Dederich he had taken a room in town at Ava Price's. There was a lady named Ava Price in Tefton, and she did rent rooms. But she hadn't had a boarder that May who fit the description of Dederick's hired man. Just the usual fellows in checked suits and derby hats hauling sample cases. Drummers, in other words. McGee had been able to tell me that because he stopped at Mrs. Price's and checked on his way back from the Dederich farm. That's how upset he was. "Even so," he added, "there's no law against a man sleeping rough in the woods, Mr. Edgecombe. I've done it a time or two myself." The hired man didn't sleep at the Dederichs' house, but he took dinner with them twice. He would have met Howie. He would have met the girls, Cora and Kathy. He would have listened to their chatter, some of which might have been about how much they looked forward to the coming summer, because if they were good and the weather was good, Mommy sometimes let them sleep out on the porch, where they could pretend they were pioneer wives crossing the Great Plains in Conestoga wagons. I can see him sitting there at the table, eating roast chicken and Mrs. Dederich's rye bread, listening, keeping his wolf's eyes well veiled, nodding, smiling a little, storing it all up. "This doesn't sound like the wild man you told me about when he first came on the mile, Paul," Janice said doubtfully. "Not a bit." "You didn't see him up at Indianola Hospital, ma'am," Harry said, "just standing there with his mouth open and his bare butt hanging out the back of his johnny, letting us dress him. We thought he's either drugged or foolish, didn't we, Dean?" Dean nodded. The day after he finished the barn and left, a man wearing a bandana mask robbed Hampy's freight office in Jarvis, I told them. Got away with $70. He also took an 1892 silver dollar the freight agent carried as a lucky piece. That silver dollar was on Wharton when he was captured, and Jarvis is only 30 miles from Tefton. "So this robber, this wild man, you think he just stopped for 3 days to help Klaus Dederich paint his barn?" my wife said. "Ate dinner with them and said, 'Please pass the peas,' just like folks." "The scariest thing about men like him is how unpredictable they are," Brutal said. "He might have been planning to kill the Dedericks and rifle their house, then changed his mind because a cloud came over the sun at the wrong time or something like. Maybe he just wanted to cool off a little. But most likely, he already had his eye on those two girls and was planning to come back. Do you think, Paul?" I nodded. Of course I thought it. "And then there's the name he gave Dederick."
"What name?" Jan asked.
"Will Bonney."
"Bonney? I don't..."
"It was Billy the Kid's real name."
"Oh."
Then her eyes widened.
"Oh! So you can get John Coffey off. Thank God! All you have to do is show Mr. Dederich a picture of William Wharton. His mugshot should do."
Brutal and I exchanged an uncomfortable look. Dean was looking a bit hopeful, but Harry was staring down at his hands, as if all at once fabulously interested in his fingernails.
"What's wrong?" Janice asked. "Why are you looking at each other that way? Surely this man McGee will have to..."
"Rob McGee struck me as a good man, and I think he's a hell of a law officer," I said, "but he swings no weight in Trepingas County. The power there is Sheriff Kribus, and the day he reopens the Dederich case on the basis of what I was able to find out would be the day it snows in hell."
"But if Wharton was there, if Dederich can identify a picture of him, and they know he was there..."
"Him being there in May doesn't mean he came back and killed those girls in June," Brutal said. He spoke in a low, gentle voice, the way you speak when you're telling someone there's been a death in the family.
On one hand, you've got this fella who helped Klaus Dederich paint a barn and then went away. Turns out he was committing crimes all over the place, but there's nothing against him for the 3 days in May he was around Tefton. On the other hand, you've got this big Negro, this huge Negro that you found on the riverbank holding two little dead girls, both of them naked, in his arms. He shook his head. Paul's right, Jan. McGee may have his doubts, but McGee doesn't matter. Kribis is the only one who can reopen the case, and Kribis doesn't want to mess with what he thinks of as a happy ending. It was a nigger, thinks he, and not one of ourn in any case. Beautiful. I'll go up there to Cold Mountain, have me a steak and a draft beer at Ma's, and watch him fry, and there's an end to it. Janice listened to all this with a mounting expression of horror on her face, then turned to me. But McGee believes it, doesn't he, Paul? I could see it on your face. Deputy McGee knows he arrested the wrong man. Won't he stand up to the sheriff?
All he can do by standing up to him is lose his job, I said.
Yes, I think that in his heart he knows it was Wharton. But what he says to himself is that if he keeps his mouth shut and plays the game until Kribis either retires or eats himself to death, he gets the job, and things will be different then. That's what he tells himself to get to sleep, I imagine. And he's probably not so much different from Homer about one thing. He'll tell himself, after all, it's only a Negro. It's not like they're going to burn a white man for it.
Then you'll have to go to them, Janice said. And my heart turned cold at the decisive, no-doubt-about-it tone of her voice. Go and tell them what you found out.
And how should we tell them we found it out, Jan? Brutal asked her in that same low voice. Should we tell them about how Wharton grabbed John while we were taking him out of the prison to work a miracle on the warden's wife?
No, of course not, but...
She saw how thin the ice was in that direction and skated in another one.
Lie, then, she said.
She looked defiantly at Brutal, then turned that look on me. It was hot enough to smoke a hole in newspaper, you'd have said. Lie, I repeated. Lie about what?
About what got you going. First up to Putnam County and then down to Topanga's. Go down there to that fat old Sheriff Kribis and say that Wharton told you he raped and murdered the Dederich girls, that he confessed.
She switched her hot gaze to Brutal for a moment.
You can back him up, Brutus. You can say you were there when he confessed. You heard it, too. Why, Percy probably heard it as well, and that was probably what set him off. He shot Wharton because he couldn't stand thinking of what Wharton had done to those children. It snapped his mind. Just...
What?
What now, in the name of God?
It wasn't just me and Brutal. Harry and Dean were looking at her, too, with a kind of horror.
We never reported anything like that, ma'am, Harry said.
He spoke as if talking to a child.
The first thing people would ask is why we didn't. We're supposed to report anything our cell babies say about prior crimes, theirs or anyone else's.
Not that we would have believed him, Brutal put in. A man like Wild Bill Wharton lies about anything, Jan. Crimes he's committed, big shots he's known, women he's gone to bed with, touchdowns he scored in high school, even the damn weather.
But...
Her face was agonized. I went to put my arm around her, and she pushed it violently away.
But he was there. He painted their goddamned barn. He ate dinner with them.
All the more reason why he might take credit for the crime, Brutal said. After all, what harm? Why not boast? You can't fry a man twice, after all.
Let me see if I've got this right. We here at this table know that not only did John Coffey not kill those girls, he was trying to save their lives. Deputy McGee doesn't know all that, of course, but he does have a pretty good idea that the man condemned to die for the murders didn't do them. And still, you can't get him a new trial. Can't even reopen the case.
Yes'm, Dean said. He was polishing his glasses furiously. That's about the size of it. She sat with her head lowered, thinking. Brutal started to say something, and I raised a hand, shushing him. I didn't believe Janice could think of a way to get John out of the killing box he was in, but I didn't believe it was impossible, either. She was a fearsomely smart lady, my wife. Fearsomely determined as well. That's a combination that sometimes turns mountains into valleys.
All right, she said at last. Then you've got to get him out on your own.
Ma'am? Harry looked flabbergasted. Frightened, too.
You can do it. You did it once, didn't you? You can do it again. Only this time you won't bring him back.
Would you want to be the one to explain to my kids why their daddy's in prison, Mrs. Edgecombe? Dean asked, charged with helping a murderer escape jail.
There won't be any of that, Dean. We'll work out a plan, make it look like a real escape.
Make sure it's a plan that could be worked out by a fella who can't even remember how to tie his own shoes, then, Harry said. They'll have to believe that.
She looked at him uncertainly.
It wouldn't do any good, Brutal said. Even if we could think of a way, it wouldn't do any good.
Why not?
She sounded as if she might be going to cry.
Just why the damn hell not?
Because he's a 6'8", bald-headed black man with barely enough brains to feed himself, I said. How long do you think it would be before he was recaptured? 2 hours? 6?
He got along without attracting much attention before, she said.
A tear trickled down her cheek. She slapped it away with the heel of her hand. That much was true. I had written letters to some friends and relatives of mine farther down south asking if they'd seen anything in the papers about a man fitting John Coffey's description, anything at all. Janice had done the same. We had come up with just one possible sighting so far in the town of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. A twister had struck a church there during choir practice in 1929, this had been, and a large black man had hauled two fellows out of the rubble. Both had looked dead to onlookers at first, but as it turned out, neither had been even seriously hurt. It was like a miracle, one of the witnesses was quoted as saying. The black man, a drifter who had been hired by the church pastor to do a day's worth of chores, had disappeared in the excitement.
You're right, he got along, Brutal said. But you have to remember that he did most of his getting along before he was convicted of raping and murdering two little girls.
She sat without answering. She sat that way for almost a full minute, and then she did something which shocked me as badly as my sudden flow of tears must have shocked her. She reached out and shoved everything off the table with one wide sweep of her arm. Plates, glasses, cups, silverware, the bowl of collards, the bowl of squash, the platter with the carved ham on it, the milk, the pitcher of cold tea, all off the table and onto the floor. Kersmash!
Holy shit! Dean cried, rocking back from the table so hard he damn near went over on his back.
Janice ignored him. It was Brutal and me she was looking at, mostly me.
"Do you mean to kill him, you cowards?" she asked. "Do you mean to kill the man who saved Melinda Moore's life? Who tried to save those little girls' lives? Well, at least there will be one less black man in the world, won't there? You can console yourselves with that! One less nigger!"
She got up, looked at her chair, and kicked it into the wall. It rebounded and fell into the spilled squash. I took her wrist, and she yanked it free.
"Don't touch me!" she said. Next week this time you'll be a murderer, no better than that man Wharton, so don't touch me.
She went out onto the back stoop, put her apron up to her face, and began to sob into it. The four of us looked at each other. After a little bit, I got on my feet and set about cleaning up the mess. Brutal joined me first, then Harry and Dean. When the place looked more or less shipshape again, they left. None of us said a word the whole time. There was really nothing left to say.